Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, welcome back to another Bald Move Pulp podcast. Boy, we have a real-time capsule podcast for you. This is our review of The Matrix. That was a commission by Jefferson Betmarek that was almost 10 years ago, released on June 29, 2015. Guaranteed there's not a lot of people that have heard this podcast, have been around that long, and you're like, why are we resuming this ancient podcast from the dead? March 31st marks the 25th anniversary of The Matrix entering theaters and blowing my mind clean out of its skull.
Mm-hmm.
I know you feel the same way about it, Jim. It just came up in last week's lunch. Someone asked us, like, I've never seen The Matrix before. I finally saw it this weekend. I was kind of whelmed by it.
Yeah. I understand. I can understand that here. 25 years later, it shocks me every time I think 25 years since The Matrix.
Yeah.
It's been longer since The Matrix than I was old when I saw The Matrix.
Dude, crazy. Same.
By a good margin.
I'm a little bit older. Yeah. It's crazy. This, if Matrix was a person, it could legally rent a vehicle. From any reputable rental agency in the country. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I do think that this would be an instructive podcast to listen to if you were a person who said, why is The Matrix a big deal? Because I know we go in quite a bit into its influentiality, how the special effects and the design of the movie were kind of like, I think, whether it's intentional or not, kind of future-proofed it in terms of special effects and whatnot. We'll get into the philosophy, our personal feelings about it. It's a great podcast. I strangely have a lot of memories of this. Maybe it's because it's got to be one of the first things we recorded, and this got to be one of the first commissioned podcasts we ever did.
Okay, yeah, that's early.
So I don't want to belabor the point too much because we got an hour and a half of Matrix talk waiting for you. Happy 25th anniversary to The Matrix, and we'll see you on a future podcast. Enjoy.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Commission podcast series, Bald Move. We've got another one today that is excellent, truly excellent. It's one of my favorite all-time movies. Got to thank Jefferson Betmarek very much.
Yeah, this is a trend. Like, it's agonizing, man. Tell us what you want, goddammit.
So he said,
I don't want this responsibility.
I want you to do either The Matrix or Heat. How do you choose between those two movies? I'll tell you how I chose.
I've got, like, when
the one that I've seen 1,000 times, went with. The one that I've seen once, I decided not to go
sure.
with.
Sure. Like, if someone told me you have already talked to Jim for 20 hours about The Matrix trilogy, I'd be like, that might even be low.
We have spent a
lot of time talking about The Matrix series, both when we first saw it and then years later. It's incredible. I mean, is it a truly great film? I kind of feel like it is. Like, in the same way that Star Wars is truly great.
You know,
you can't mention it with The Godfather, shit like that, but it's still fuck you, it's a great movie.
Sure, and I think, you know, going back to it 16 years later, this movie was released in 99.
Yep.
Coming back 16 years later, it feels like most of it holds up.
And I thought it held up like a champ.
Yeah, surprisingly, for an action and effects oriented film.
And we're going to talk
about rare
ways I think that they were smart about going about the way they did things.
Yeah. And some ways in which it falls flat. But
sure.
For the most part, I think it held up. And I feel like judging this film as, you know, I was 17 years old when this thing came out. Mm-hmm. So when I saw this for the first time, there were things in there that I hadn't even understood you could ask questions about.
Sure.
You know? Like, this idea of The Matrix was a brand new concept for me.
Yeah.
And sure, it's been written about before.
Yeah.
I didn't do a whole lot of reading.
Had a had some ideas about it once upon
yeah,
a time.
There's the stuff in the cave. Absolutely. I mean, all of that stuff is tied in here, but this was the first time I was introduced to it, and so it fucking blew my mind.
Yeah. And it's another one of those rare films where when I see it, I saw it at the theater, and I was kind of...
You weren't supposed to.
I wasn't supposed to.
I know. Shame on you.
I snuck out and saw this theater as a grown-ass man that lived in my own house.
Had to sneak out to see a rated R movie.
I saw it twice in the same week.
Nice.
Like and I just thought it was... I mean, I came out of that movie wanting to beat someone up. Like, yeah. There's a couple of movies that are just so fucking cool that it just just gives you this shot of adrenaline, and you want to go out and brawl with a bunch of agents,
yeah,
and fly helicopters and know kung fu. And there's still some really visceral thrills to mm-hmm. enjoy in this film. Like the fights still really hold up.
They're incredible. I was in the same boat as you. I went and saw this with, surprisingly, a group of people who were not supposed to see this movie. Somehow,
I know what group you ran with. That doesn't surprise me at all.
It wasn't even that group. Well, it was a lot of that group. But it was a lot of the group that you wouldn't suspect would be watching a movie like this.
Yeah.
Like,
oh,
that's the thing. This was such a phenomenon back in the day. Like, yeah. You heard about this movie and everyone was saying you have to see it.
Yeah.
I can't think of a single person who didn't love this movie.
Well, it's funny because we talked about it where we're watching it about our buddy, the Laugh Man.
Yeah.
And how... Because he was the straightest of straight-laced Jehovah's Witness youths.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he really was the archetype of lived with his... Like, he was in his late 20s, never had a girlfriend,
yeah.
Lived with his parents, waved to his mom goodbye as he drove down their long-ass country driveway until she couldn't see him every fucking time. And I... Because he was this big science fiction fan, I begged him, I'm like, dude... You should see this movie. I was like full on. I was the devil on his shoulder. Like, there's no nudity. There's like very little graphic violence.
Very little language.
I don't even think they say the word fuck. I don't think so. They do flip somebody off.
Yeah.
Had the rated R. He will not see a rated R movie. But crazy. Yeah, it broke a lot of us.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, half the people there who went and saw it with my group probably would not have seen any other rated R movie at the time.
But it's like... The advertising campaign was brilliant too, because they showed all these fantastic things and all these mundane
effects.
Things. And you're like, is this a superhero film? Is this trippy, you know, serpent in a rainbow type of thing going on? Like, what the hell? And it manages to keep that suspense through the first third of the movie.
That's what I feel like, you know, you can't show in a preview. You don't want to be shown what the Matrix is until you need to be.
Yeah.
You know? Otherwise, why are you watching that movie?
Yeah.
I don't want to see that in the preview.
I mean, it's funny because it's got one of the most memorable twists in movie history as far as its premise. But then it also doesn't rely on that. Like, it's a genuinely entertaining film that you can come back to again and again and again.
Yeah, and I feel like going into this, if you know the twist, if you know that the Matrix is what the Matrix is, then it takes away the enjoyment of the first part of the movie, which I feel is the confusion, right?
Yeah.
Like, we're supposed to be in Neo's shoes going, what the fuck am I? What is going on here?
It just doesn't work that well.
How do these people know where everything is?
Yep.
How are these people running up walls and jumping across buildings? I don't fucking get it. This is bizarre. You need to feel that. Just like Neo does at the beginning.
Agreed. And like, I'm not a bit, you know, I don't really care about spoilers, but man, there's a couple films, like A Sixth Sense is one of them. The Matrix is another, where I would be super bummed out if that was spoiled, because I think The Matrix is fine. Like, it rewards multiple watchings and stuff, but like, the feeling of the same thing with Game of Thrones, you know, like some of its big moments, like, it would suck to have those spoiled, because you only get to kind of feel that. You don't get to feel that way very many times in any kind of media.
True.
And a few times where you do get to get, you know, sucker punched, I think you should enjoy them.
I agree. And this is one of those ultimate times, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
What were you thinking? Like, you go into this theater and you're seeing this for the first time. Trinity's running up the walls. She's jumping in the air while the camera spins around her, and she freezes.
Yeah, the bullet time stuff
first
was
use
so
of it.
Incredible. And it's still, again, like, some of the things you know, I remember like being a pretty big fan of the Charlie's Angels remake with Drew Barrymore and all that. And they used a lot of this stuff too. When you go back and rewatch that movie, a lot of it's really fucking trite and tedious. Like, it's like, man, this is really showy and drawing attention to itself in a way that I don't feel The Matrix does, even though it was the thing that started the cliche.
I don't know why it gets away with it, honestly. I mean, it is the thing that started it. So there's that, right? Like, everything that came after this, like, movies, what was the fucking movie?
These were things that people have been doing.
The Scream farce. Parody, Scary whatever movie. It is. Scary Movie did this shit, right? Uh-huh. Like, it got so overused after this that you couldn't ever view it the same way. But having that first experience seeing this was amazing.
And I think it fits in a way that didn't seem like it was showy, in a way that even the Matrix successors, the Reloaded and Revolutions, starts to feel victim of the Charlie's Angelsification of the effect. It's like, well, we did this. How do we top it? And sometimes it works. Like, there's a couple of stuff that in all the Matrix movies, I don't think they're terrible films start to finish. And I'm a really big fan of the second one.
Yeah.
The third one's a mess. And and we can talk about that maybe at the end, like, just real briefly, what the Matrix trilogy did to the Matrix, the movie.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, I feel like.
But you're right. There are moments like big scenes, like the truck scene in Reloaded. The highway scene, whatever it is.
Yeah.
Those feel kind of effortless in the same way that the first movie feels.
Sure.
And I don't know if it's just the cause of having not seen that stuff before or.
Yeah, it felt like a genuine raising of the stakes to serve a narrative purpose.
Yeah.
Whereas, and then that's what all of the Matrix, like when we saw crazy shit, it was partially to expose Neo to it.
Uh-huh.
Partially to expose us to it, and also to make the final act work as such an incredible piece. Like, you know, I feel like you go into that third act thinking that Neo is not the one.
Yeah.
And that he's going to have to do some kind of crazy sacrifice to save Morpheus, and it might cost him his life. Like,
yeah,
you know,
and all the effects and cool action stuff that you've seen.
Yeah.
You know, I'm with you. They really service that final portion where it gets ratcheted up yet again. And you're thinking, how can this final confrontation in the hallway be even half as cool as what I've seen in the lobby and what I've seen even in the dojo?
Yeah.
Like, those are awesome moments. There are so many awesome moments like that throughout this film that when you go into the final thing, you're thinking, okay, what can they do to really hook me here? And then they ratchet it up again.
Sure.
They're flexing the Matrix by the end of this, and Neo has become the one. He doesn't even care, right? Uh-huh. He's like, "What? I'm gonna fight you with one hand because it doesn't matter. I'm gonna stop these bullets because I'm fucking awesome."
Yeah, I now see the world behind the world, and interfacing at this level is
and we do elementary. Too, right? Like, that's the moment where the Matrix itself turns into the green code and everything.
And like you said, when he jumps into Smith, takes him over, explodes him, and then he does that flex, and it literally warps the world around him. It's just so fucking cool.
That's a stand up and cheer moment.
Yeah,
like few others in cinema history for me.
Yeah,
and it's probably a consequence of being 17 and seeing this for the first time.
Sure,
you know? But it's also partially, this was the craziest thing anyone had ever seen up to this point.
Yeah. And I don't know. I wonder. Sometimes, you know, I wonder whether our reaction or enthusiasm is exactly as you said. We both had young man brains.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're sex nuts, and we've completely unfamiliar cinematic tropes. And
sure,
you know, a 40-year-old man going to see that in 97 would, or like a woman would be rolling their eyes and be like, oh, God.
Maybe so.
But I don't know. I mean, the success of the film seems to belie that.
It seems like it, yeah. I mean, it was a very successful film.
I don't know about the staying power of them, though. Like,
what do you mean?
I feel like when Star Wars came out, Star Wars remained socially relevant, you know, forever. It never really went away. There was a small period of time where it was more of a niche nerd type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, but The Matrix, now that we're 15 years past it, like, it doesn't seem as culturally relevant as Harry Potter.
Yeah, do people still talk about The Matrix?
Yeah.
It doesn't seem like they do. And I wonder if that's partially because
the Wachowskis have crapped the bed.
Yeah, the Wachowskis went on to do some stuff that was not all that great. And also, you know, The Matrix has not been producing content that in that series.
You're right.
This entire time, unlike Star Wars, which, you know, had
action figures, and
VHS releases, and this like all this stuff that came out.
Yeah,
yeah, all the merchandising behind Star Wars kept it in the popular, you know, in the spotlight.
I do wonder if that's entirely a consequence of the fact that, you know, if Matrix Reloaded was the Empire Strikes Back to the Matrix, if it took that and just elevated it in every possible way instead of just, I feel like Matrix Reloaded was essentially the X-Files later seasons. It just kept kicking the interesting questions and increasing the scope and the grandeur of those questions and promising the answers. And then Matrix Revolutions came back and it's like, oh, geez, this is it.
We can't actually answer all this stuff.
Or like, here's the answer and it's super kind of unsatisfying, which I'm not even sure if I'm prepared to defend that anymore. About a month before this was commissioned, I saw The Matrix Revolutions just with a good 5 years since I've seen The Matrix the last time.
Okay.
And just kind of in isolation. And I'm like, I don't remember why I hated this. Yes, the scenes of the Zion defense were tedious and they went on far too long.
Mm.
But I don't know that that's necessarily a crime. Like, you could say the same thing about Return of the Jedi, essentially. But
with the Ewoks.
I think the crucial thing is the second one was not The Empire Strikes Back. You could forgive a weak Revolutions. Yeah. But the fact that The Matrix was mind-blowing and none of the other two really were.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, Star Wars, you know, Return of the Jedi kind of goes back to the beginning in a way.
Yeah.
You know, Death Star 2 and all that stuff. So it's kind of satisfying at that base level.
Yeah.
Of like, yeah, you've seen it before, but it also feels very familiar. And it also feels like I've got all these same characters who I know and love.
We'll be right back with more Bald Move after this brief pause.
Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
Executive producers get to exercise their voting fingers again this week with another prestige movie poll. This week's nominees are Mystic River, The Last Samurai, and Secondhand Lions. Take your pick and seal our fate.
This Monday on the premium feed, we open up the books and deliver a State of the Empire podcast, talking about the current condition of Bald Move and our plans for this year.
This Friday, it's lunch 420, which given last weekend seems like a tragic missed opportunity. Ah well. Lunch will be served piping hot at 1 p.m. Eastern. Come join live or warm up some leftovers when lunch is released in podcast form later that day.
If you want more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content plus ad-free feeds. You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk podcasts, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today.
And now, back with more Bald Move. And they're going to have their adventures, not in the same way, because you weren't expecting everything to be like wrapped up in this neat bow at the end of Return of the Jedi, right?
Right.
You were expecting another romp, another adventure, another
I think that
adventure in the Star Wars universe. Whereas The Matrix, you had huge expectations for.
Sure.
And also in the plot.
Also, you The Matrix did. Like, I'm trying to think. After Star Wars, you could tell lots more stories about Luke and Han and Leia, and people did. After The Matrix,
you could tell another Matrix story.
Yeah, the way they set that up is like, maybe it's interesting to see how humans and machines coexist and rebuilding the Earth after ending their hostilities. And I guess there were some really interesting things that happened in the MMORPG version of The Matrix.
The Matrix, yeah.
People said that that was really, really cool if you stuck with it and, you know, accepted kind of the poor graphics and the other stuff. The story was really cool. But yeah, where do you go? Maybe there's some interesting stuff, but like, I felt like I didn't really need to know more about, well, first of all, Neo's dead, and so is Trinity. So
yeah,
it was much more definitive, and like, I guess you could have them as being Neo reborn, or maybe he's still alive in a Matrix, because there's certainly some hints in that, but the story was over.
Yeah.
The story was over. There's no other just like, you know, good guy versus bad guy, like,
that's the thing. Like, none of the characters in Star Wars are dead at the end of it, right?
Sure.
Like, we know that there are always going to be bad guys out there for them.
Well,
to fight.
You know, Porkins, never forget.
Nah, who cares? But there are going to be other bad guys out there for them to fight, and those are the people we cared about, the ones that survived. So that series can live on in them, you know. Whereas, like, yeah, you lose Neo, you lose Trinity, you lose all the characters you care about.
Right.
It doesn't matter if there's another bad guy out there to fight, because we don't have any good guys to fight them that we care about.
Sure.
So.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. I wonder if another 15 years will go by and someone will revive it, or like,
could be.
I mean, I would get behind a remake of The Matrix. Like, the first movie would be very much like the original Matrix, and then they diverge. I want to take this good foundation, and I've had 30 years to think about it, and I want to do something else with it. I want to take it in another direction.
I almost kind of fear a remake of the original Matrix, though. Like, I don't think it's necessary. You know, the effects are not that much better at this point.
Okay. What if they do this? They don't remake the Matrix. They do remake Reloaded. Like, kind of like the same way that the Superman that what's his face made, that had the other guy, Brandon Roush, the one before new one. Mm-hmm. It was kind of like the way that history works is Superman 3 and 4 probably didn't exist. This is just like a spiritual sequel to the world that Richard Donner built.
Yeah. Superman Returns?
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
I wonder if it would work like that, where you just come back and like, Reloaded and Revolutions never happened. We are remaking those two. But the first one's a perfect movie. Why would, you know... You'd have to cast it. That's the other thing is Keanu Reeves was really perfect for this role.
He was, yeah. He got a woe in there.
His cluelessness and kind of dopey acting fit this character like a glove. In the same way that, like, I know you haven't seen it yet, but John Wick is another...
I just added it to my HBO watch list.
It's another movie that really takes maximum advantage of his particular skill set.
Cool. Okay.
Like Speed.
Yeah.
Bill and Ted. Those are shit in his wheelhouse.
I was reading an article the other day about Keanu Reeves, and like, he's had a pretty fucking tragic life.
Like, yeah.
He has had so many horrible things happen to him and come out then the other side as a really cool human being.
Every time I see an interview with him, and he's done a lot of Reddit AMAs, he seems like a very grounded, genuine, humble, generous person.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I've seen videos of him on the subway, like, okay, Los Angeles, New York City, wherever he's at. He's riding the subway as a multi-millionaire. He gives and he gets up out of his seat to give people his chairs on the subway. Like,
yeah, and on The Matrix, he famously split his salary with the stunt crew and the production people.
He has taken less salary to get other people on board so a project can get made. Like, he seems like a really, really cool dude. And I mean, he's just had a lot of stuff happen to him in his life that I'm surprised he can be as cool as he is.
I don't know. Maybe it takes a certain amount of tragedy to enable a super famous person to stay grounded. Like, he might be an insufferable asshole minus the tragedy.
If he had just had everything handed to him, he'd be more expecting of it. Yeah, potentially. So I want to ask you, asked me a question during the film about Lawrence Fishburne, like what you thought was his more recognizable role, Morpheus in The Matrix or... I think this is telling. Whatever character he played in Apocalypse Now.
Or what about his street chess mentor role in Search of Bobby Fischer?
Uh-huh. Yep.
Pretty iconic. I mean...
That was good, actually. I really enjoyed him in that.
Like, I don't feel this way about a lot of people in the movie, because a lot of movies, the people in the movie are quite literally replaceable. Like Carrie Ann Moss.
Yeah, probably.
The guy who played Tank, obviously they were replaceable because the Wachowskis decided to. He tried.
They big timed.
Yeah, Tank, a little too much. Tank tried the role of Clemenza on the Wachowskis. And they're like, that didn't even fucking work for Clemenza. He's out. And now you are too. Died off screen, motherfucker. But I feel like Lawrence Fishburne as Morpheus just crushed it. And I can't imagine.
He's perfect.
I'm like, you know, who else did you get for that role that is able to convey the badassitude, the like monk-like wisdom, the certitude in his convictions, and not come off as smug and insufferable?
I don't know, man.
Like, there's still enough. The way he plays his belief in Neo has just enough doubt and mania about that doubt.
Yeah.
Like, when he comes out of the water well, I've always felt like that he's,
you know,
pretty sure
he
has faith, but it's like not the smug, self-serving faith. It's like the faith that still entertains doubt. And that's why it's so awesome when he comes out like that.
I was initially thinking like maybe a Forrest Whitaker could pull it off. He does some roles like that. I'm really reminded, though, in that performance of Leonardo DiCaprio in Inception. Kind of that like loose cannon, a little unhinged, but knows what he's talking about also, sort of thing.
And he's a leader. He also inspires loyalty, even in, which I always thought that worked really well, that like even though Neo is the one and he's like the baddest of ass, he always kind of defers to Morpheus because
he's
got
more,
that respect.
You know? He's got experience.
I feel that way about Keanu Reeves as Neo. Like, there's not a lot of people that could pull that. You know, you put Channing Tatum in that role and it's a fucking disaster. Channing Tatum.
Or Jason Statham.
You put Jason Statham and it's a fucking disaster. I'm trying to think who else. Hugo Weaving as Agent Smith.
He's absolutely perfect.
This is the movie that unleashed Hugo Weaving onto the world. Like, maybe if you're a Kiwi or an Australian, you were familiar with his work, but I'd never heard of this motherfucker.
Me either.
And he, like,
what good is a phone call if you are unable to?
His character is like one of the instantly recognizable iconic villains of all time. He's like, he's almost in the single movie up there with Vader.
For me, anyway,
up there with Maximilian from the Black Hole. He's just this implacable foe, but he's also got this really, like, I love how they play him at the end as if he is like some kind of deviant. Like, even the other agents are like,
and you know, he turns out to be one, right?
He is, yeah.
Like, by the end of the series as a whole,
which
he
that
is a
I
rogue
will say
program.
That the whole Agent Smith plot is the one thing, the one note that throughout the series plays fairly true.
I thought so.
Like, even to the end.
Yeah.
Like,
the idea of this kind of sentience within the machine, discovering that maybe they don't even want the machine. Like, it's really cool.
Yeah.
And you start to see pieces of that.
And I also wonder if... I also wondered if that was part of the control mechanism, that when a one forms, that there's always an Agent Smith. Or if the same way that Neo had a certain abilities about him that broke the chain of the Matrixes, if Agent Smith was almost like a chaos theory type butterfly flap that allowed him to be what he became.
Yeah.
Like, it felt like that the machines were not expecting Smith and that he had to be dealt with or everything was going to be lost.
It seems like it, yeah. I mean, certainly not in this first
By
film,
the end of the movie, he took over every human being's conscious on Earth.
Yeah.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah, if you haven't seen Revolutions.
But that still won't make a bit of, like, I don't feel like I've spoiled anything for you. The journey is very much the destination in this case.
Yeah, it's interesting how that kind of ties into the idea that Morpheus espouses in this first episode, this first movie, about everyone in the Matrix being your enemy at this current moment.
Yes.
You know, because they can all be Agent Smith. They could all be an agent or part of the system, since they are not outside of the system, which I think is interesting from a philosophical and a plot perspective.
The other thing about Hugo Weaving I thought is remarkable, there's two things. I'm going to save the one for dead last.
All
but
right.
The physicality of his performance, he's a very slight guy.
Mm-hmm.
But he sells punching through concrete walls and wrecking Neo and doing all the other crazy stuff really, really well. Like, at no point am I ever And it's part because I completely buy into the in-universe rules where your size matters not, Yoda. But, he really does convey that pure raw physicality of this agent, but also this super intelligence.
Yeah.
And this, malevolence. That's kind of hard to do.
I'm with you. He's a perfect choice for that role. And I think more importantly, like you said, the movie sets us up for that, right? It's not like... You could basically buy anybody. Would you buy, like, Mouse goes in there, would you buy that he's a little faster and a little stronger than an average human being?
No, not particularly.
No?
Okay. No.
All right.
But I think Mouse...
in the rules of the film, I feel like you have to, right? Like, if they showed that...
But I feel like Mouse was the least badass of the crew.
Easily,
and
without a doubt.
And that's how he got, like, he didn't even get his guns up shooting. But that felt appropriate.
Okay.
I tell you what's scary is, like, if The Matrix was made 5 years after it was, Mouse would be casted as Shia LaBeouf.
Oh, Jesus, you're right.
And I feel like that might have ruined the film.
There'd be a lot more stuttering in his lines.
It'd be pretty rough.
Uh-huh.
So we dodged a bullet there. I think we can all agree.
I agree with that, yeah.
The other thing about Hugo Weaving... The man's teeth, and I'm not talking like condition of, I'm talking about the physical morphology of his front teeth.
Size and positioning, like that kind of stuff?
They're human molars that someone has installed into his incisor position. Okay. And every single time, like once you see it, you cannot unsee it. Every single time he grits his teeth towards the end of the movie, they're not normal chiclets, man.
No, they get progressively bigger too. I mean, when he explodes...
Yeah.
At the end, we had a session over at your house when I was living there where we watched The Matrix and you said, you have to check this out. I didn't know what you're talking about. You go to the end where he's exploding. I think that's the scene, right?
I did a couple. There's like three prime scenes where if you frame by frame it, it's just like, I think I played that game.
You get to a point where like you go, okay, his teeth are absurdly huge.
Yeah. Like,
and then you go a few frames more and it's like, those are the biggest teeth I've ever seen.
Right.
A few frames more, they can't possibly get any bigger.
Yeah, no.
And then 2 minutes later, you're still going frame by frame.
Yeah.
And they've encompassed the entire screen. And your
mind
is bent.
And you can park a Buick in the gap between the two of them.
It's incredible.
It is interesting because that was a game I played. It's like, you tell me, like every time I do a frame, tell me when you think it's going to cut.
Uh-huh.
And you guys were both, it was like you, me, and Peter, you're both like, no, there's no fucking, this is it. And yeah, you'd keep on going.
Yeah, pretty amazing.
Maybe we should do a cut, like a dental cut of The Matrix, just to have like 10 seconds of...
dental cut. Yeah, maybe so.
Sink your teeth into it. So let's talk about one of the reasons why I think this movie really holds up, and that they made... I mean, I think they were going for this intentionally cyberpunk aesthetic.
Oh, yeah.
And they were pulling in, like, dial-up phones and, like, fucking Jacob's ladders and theremins and, like, all the old classic stuff in the middle of state-of-the-art cell phone. And when I say state-of-the-art, it's amazing how the art has moved on 15 years. But state-of-the-art computer workstations and, Nokia phones and all that stuff. It kind of like is a world that's eternally 1999, but the future tech is very old school, rotary phone type stuff that makes it seem like it's still advanced, which is really cool because whenever they show tech in The Matrix, you know, it's like, what am I actually seeing? I'm not actually seeing this technology in the sense that this is soldered together by somebody. I'm seeing... Yeah. The physical residual self-image of whatever hocus-pocus program they're using. Just like when Agent Smith busts out the belly button worm, is that thing really a horrific scorpion creature or is it a little transistor tracking device? Is it both?
Yeah. Well, it's the juxtaposition of like this 1950s tech with this $21.99, I think. Or he says it's closer to $21.99. With this super far future tech, right?
Like EMPs and
and all the robotics and stuff. I mean, all this H.R. Geiger-esque type, really horrifying imagery.
Body horror in this movie, with all the hoses and the belly, like, and
we'll get there. I'm just talking about like the disparity between like the old school stuff and the really really new school stuff. like far future stuff.
But then
I think
also,
that's what makes it work. But you're right. There's a middle ground where you're kind of stuck in the late 90s.
Yeah. And that's inside the Matrix. But I also like that even the Human Resistance, they have that blend of like amazing hover type technology and EMPs. But then they've got beat up dentist chairs with dirty reusable brain needles. Like they're just keeping that shit alive, and they've cobbled together shit to interface with the new stuff. And it just works. It really
that feels
really
right
works.
Though, because even like when you go to Star Wars, that's what Star Wars does too, right? Like they take all of this old, dirty feeling tech, and even if it's like far future stuff that we can't possibly imagine yet, it still feels used, and it feels like it's cobbled together in a lot of ways with the rebellion and stuff. And I feel like they do the same thing here, and it works.
Another thing I really think,
and it's timeless,
that sets you in the mood is they do a lot of interesting transitions with like surveillance, where you'll see a scene framed in like a one of those mirrors that's set in the corner so you can see both, and then it'll flip and you'll actually see that that's where the camera's at, mm-hmm. or you're looking at a surveillance monitor until you zoom in, you can actually see the individual, you know, like
the
pixels
scan lines
and the scan lines, and then it moves one step forward and now it's back in the cinema mode. There's a lot of stuff that I think they did, you know, The Wire messed around with some of that stuff too, but I think this show did it even better. And there's a lot of things that you pick up in the commentaries, which I highly recommend. All the commentaries are super informative for this, but you know, they do a lot of suggesting the Matrix by the hue. Everything's green, and like the window washer guy, the way that water was streaking down is very similar to the waterfall of code that is the Matrix encrypted. And there's a lot of like really cool touches where even subconsciously they're putting these tiny details to make you feel uncomfortable when you're inside the Matrix. Mm-hmm. And it's very inhuman and very devoid of like any kind of color or passion in life.
Yeah, no, as it should be. I'm a big fan of, you know, just all of the transitions and the effects they use in this film. Most of them are seamless. There are a few that aren't. Like if you look at some of the stuff where Neo hits the street when he fails the first jump, that looks a little cheesy and weird.
And if you want to hear like a perfectionist, listen to the technical commentary, because the visual effects guy essentially hates fully half of the visual effects in this movie.
Okay.
Like he's like, this Agent Smith being absorbed by Neo and exploding is amateur hack job. I'm embarrassed professionally. Yeah. Like he calls out like a lot of stuff that I thought was really good, but
I've felt like that with every website I've ever built.
Yeah.
Like the day after it's published, you're like, that shit.
And
I'll never do anything that bad again.
The sheer amount of visual effects and practical effects, the fact that two or three misfire, but then you look at that lobby scene where you think of like all the digital compositing, the squibs, the stunt work, everything had to go on. The nightmare that set must have been to reset, like in between takes.
Uh-huh.
It's amazing how well it all works, and is just
it is
beautiful.
And the fact that they were inventing most of this stuff at the time, you know, that 360 camera view wasn't a thing.
Yeah.
It had never been done.
And we've seen crazy camera angles, and we've seen wire kung fu, and we've seen awesome stunt work, but combining them all together very seamlessly is pretty incredible.
I don't feel like you could have really made the Matrix feel like the Matrix without it, honestly.
Yeah.
Like if I'm supposed to believe that these people have some supernatural abilities within this construct, I need to see it, you know? And the physical representation of them running up walls and spinning around in midair and dodging bullets, you need those things to really sell the world.
And they lose a little bit. I think that's another reason that other movies never worked, is because the first Matrix felt like a really realistic, like if you had superheroes in real life, how would they behave? And it gave a perfect in-universe for how they were able to bend the physical laws, but not break them. And they kind of lose a little bit of that with Neo, you know, once he starts flying around like Superman. It's like, okay.
They do. I'm like, nothing can touch him at this point, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And they do a good job of still somehow scaling up the threats, but it's just not as ground, you know, it's like, okay, well, if he can do this, then why is he doing this in this particular, why is he still... We've seen him stop bullets and effortlessly block an agent with his bare hands. Mm-hmm. So why is he engaging in this? Why is he engaging in fisticuffs with people?
Yeah, coming out of this movie, I was like, I don't know what they're going to do in the sequels because he seems to be all powerful now. And I was thinking, oh, they're going to have to take it all outside the Matrix, right?
Yeah.
Like the battle is no longer inside the Matrix. He has won that. Now the battle comes to, you know, the Squiddies and and that kind of stuff. But, you know, they kind of combine that with an in-universe, in-Matrix battle, you know, in a way that wasn't terrible, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, this idea that there's a source to all of the code, to the machine, I thought was kind of cool. But yeah, I don't know. There's a lot of philosophical stuff that I'm sure we want to get into.
I have a bunch of just questions that I want. That these are some of these questions are old questions, and some of them are ones I came up with on this. I how many times do you think we've seen this? More than 10, less than 20? More than 10, probably. Less than 30?
Yeah, somewhere in there.
In that range?
Like, definitely more than 10.
Not as much as The Godfather, but nipping on its heels.
Yeah. Not as much as Star Wars.
Not as much as Star Wars, for sure. So here's a couple questions, and stop me wherever you want to talk about. How does residual self-image work?
Okay, I like this question. So are you talking about like from the time you're a baby?
Yeah.
Like you're a baby, you're shoved into a pod, boom, you've got to have a residual self-image.
Yes.
How does that develop?
And you've never, now I know the machines know what you look like just from a genetic basis and also what you look like in your pod. Are they feeding that to you somehow? Like when you look in the mirror, are you seeing a humanized version of the thing in the pod?
Is the residual self-image only applicable to people who have been in the Matrix and pulled out? And when they go back in, it's a residual image?
Or I imagine is that for like everyone? If you were to take Tank and Doze, now I know they're incapable of doing this, but I imagine if you would install brain ports into Tank and Doze and you plugged them into Matrix, they would still remember what they look like and they would visualize that.
Uh-huh.
But that's one thing I was like... It's interesting because it's not just the hair, it's the hairstyle and like everything. The fact that they don't remember that they have holes. I wonder if you spend enough time in the real world, if eventually you start jacking in with the holes.
It's interesting because like we have a lot of questions revolving around how these information dumps happen too. Like changing the topology of the brain in real time like that would be extraordinarily painful, probably, although your brain doesn't have pain.
Yeah, like what does it feel like to have 1,000 hours worth of martial arts experience hard written to your brain?
Yeah, we know that your brain must change in physical form in order to store those images.
I know when I've studied something for a very long time and a very intense focus, my brain hurts. Like I imagine this is feeling like eating ice cream, getting ice cream headache times 1,000. But also kind of addictive too. Like, but not just from a physical standpoint.
Is it addictive from the results or is it addictive from the process?
Well, I'm talking about like not only the physical sensation of this actually happening, but the psychic awareness of like you just became larger. Like
it's interesting because what does that say about like muscle memory? Like if you truly know Kung Fu, that doesn't mean your body's going to be able to do that shit, right? Like if I know how to jump up and do the splits, yes, in the Matrix it definitely does.
But yeah, in real life you could go through the forms, but you are not strong or fast enough to actually make it. I imagine you can get your ass kicked if you kind of like in Superman 2, and Superman gets depowered and he goes to a bar fight and he gets his ass handed to him because he's used to being Superman.
He doesn't know how to dodge a punch because he's never had to.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. You would still be able to know how to fly helicopters and stuff.
Sure.
That wouldn't be a problem. But it seems like there's some physical change that happens to the brain that necessarily, right?
It'd have to.
Yeah. Even if it's just storing a program that you can access to then know Kung Fu inside the Matrix.
And I was also wondering, like, what is the raw read-write in terms of, like, kilobits or megabits or gigabits to the brain?
The bandwidth?
How fast can you physically write neurons? That's good kind question. Of like it seems like extremely fast.
If you're the one, you could probably write them really fast. I mean, he says like he's a machine, right?
Yeah,
he's just absorbing this stuff faster than anybody I've ever seen.
Which is interesting from a series forward perspective.
Sure.
What about humans as a power source? That was the one thing that always bugged me that. We are not a very efficient source of heat. And I heard that in an early draft in Matrix that the machines ran on fusion, but they actually kept us around as an enormous battery backup. like we stored a kind of energy that they could, like if their fusion device failed and they had to restart it, that they could harness our energy to get that spark going again. And that confused, I guess, people. And so the only hint of that survives is Morpheus's line, this combined with the form of fusion, and they had all the power they need. But yeah, like the human body does not generate more energy by far than it takes in.
Of course not. No.
And like there's no fucking way you can liquefy enough people. Like you'd have to liquefy 10 to 1.
Yeah. It's so, diminishing returns. It's it's useless.
Yeah.
Except as, you know, a backup store. I could totally see that.
But I'll say that that didn't occur to me the first 3, 4, 5 times I watched the film.
Yeah.
Because the horror of humans being grown as crops and used as a that's an effective scene, like to turn a human being into this, and he holds up a copper top, which is the slur that they call humans still plugged in.
Sure. I mean, just the image of him waking up in that pod is truly horrific.
Yeah.
And
the scale
in
of
so
it,
many ways
when he looks down and sees how many pods.
Yeah. And you know that that's not the extent of it, right? What he's seeing is only a small fraction of what's actually out there. And you see the farms, you see the people being grown, as he says. That's horrifying imagery, I think, for anybody. And it was the first time I'd seen anything like that as well. So it really affected me. I have a question for you.
Shoot.
So you know that in the Matrix, if you take a severe beating, your mind, quote unquote, makes it real.
Yeah.
Right? I have some problems with this.
I suspect you do.
Okay. So my first viewing of this in the theaters, I was thinking, okay, so I saw Neo get beat up by an agent, punched in the chest a bunch. He spits up blood. He physically, his real body in the real world spits up blood. Tough for me to imagine that your mind makes that real, first of all.
Yeah.
Then you go to the scene where he is shot many, many times, and he's not spitting up blood.
Uh-huh.
His mind is effectively not making those gunshots real. And if they were to make those gunshots real, a kiss from Trinity, no matter how deep or well placed, is not going to bring him back.
Right.
If his mind created 6, 7 gunshots in his chest.
All right.
I mean, I can't imagine a scenario in which this makes any kind of logical sense. It is a movie hack.
So I've got a headcanon about this.
Okay.
Because you're right.
Drop it on me.
Like, the brain literally cannot make gunshots real. There's no human mechanism to,
it can make,
like,
pain real. I buy that.
Yeah, the pain. And, like, I also buy that if your brain, if your consciousness is uploaded into a system and that is disconnected, that you would, you'd be brain dead.
Uh-huh.
So I don't have a problem with that. So my interpretation is, if you get punched really hard, that your body can reflexively, like, snap its teeth shut or cause some kind of strain that, like, you're essentially biting your tongue or your cheek or your lip.
Like, or break your ribs with your abdominal muscles.
You're tensing up, and you can cause minor trauma to where it would cause you to spit up blood, but you can't literally die from... Now, if you think if your mind thinks it's dying in the Matrix, then I could see it causing some kind of physical shock and you actually die. I don't have a problem with, again, brain death equals real death.
I'm with you.
Although I think it's better the way they do it in Inception, where when you get killed, you just pop out of that. Like, that seems like that you'd be more inclined to wake up from the dream than to, like, oh my God, time to shut down the body. But
stream of consciousness is interrupted. You can kind of buy it.
Yeah, yeah. And I feel like they sold the technology just enough that I buy that. But that's what I think, is that you can like grit your you can make a fist so tight that your nails bite into your palm and you can bleed there. You can struggle against your restraints. You can bite your tongue, or you can cause some kind of internal.
But I don't feel like that line, your mind makes it real, reflects that state of harm to your body.
But I guess I can buy it as a simplification for someone that you're trying to say, if you die in the Matrix, it's no shit problem. And he's got blood on his mouth, and you just say that rather than, well, here's what can actually happen to you, and, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I guess if it were me, I'd be like, how did my mind make me bleed? Please tell me that. But, you know, it's a movie, and ultimately I let it go, and I said, okay, I'm going to have to not try to make this 100% consistent across the board. But, I mean, I kind of like your explanation. It makes sense. I guess you can't create gunshots, and therefore your body wouldn't react the same way.
So it's I can there. The extent of damage I saw them actually taking the chair is consistent with what you could probably do to yourself left to your own devices.
Potentially, yeah.
Would Cypher have turned on the resistance if Neo had made the jump? I've never thought about this, but this time I was watching, I had the clear impression that I think he might have stayed loyal. That he was waiting to see, like, he's been increasingly disgruntled with Morpheus as almost like a cult leader.
Yeah.
And he was thinking about betraying him, and then Morpheus actually fucking found the one. And he's like,
and this
all
was the
right,
final chance.
All right, maybe I'll believe this because look at these neural kinetics and all that stuff. But then when he missed the jump, there was a real sadness and resignation and in his performance that I think is intended to say that he might have stayed true blue if he'd have made that jump.
You could be right. I think the scene with the stake where he's sitting with Agent Smith negotiating his replacement in the Matrix happens after that.
It does.
Yeah. So that would seem reasonable.
So I'm glad you brought that up.
It's interesting. I wonder about.
I don't see how Cypher actually made that scene happen. It doesn't seem like you can jack yourself into the Matrix without an operator and certainly are not able to unjack yourself.
Yes, you cannot get out of there. Certainly.
So that seems like the one in dozens of watching, that is the one plot hole that I can't really figure out. Like, it doesn't seem like it should be physically or metaphysically possible for Cypher to have that meeting with Agent Smith.
Yeah, and I would say, like, oh, maybe he snuck off and did something else, but you've got Tank there watching the fucking thing the whole time.
Yeah.
He can see what's going on in the Matrix on those screens.
I mean, clearly there's room, wiggle room on there because Cypher did, in fact, get off onto his own. Mm-hmm. And if they played it like that, where he was freelancing on a mission, but the way they set it up, where they made it very clear he was up to no good, he was all alone, Neo kind of sort of busted him, and he drank the engine degreaser, and then he left, and the next scene is him giving the stake speech. He did that all by himself, and I don't see how he could do that.
Is there, so I'm making huge concessions here. Is there any way that the Matrix, the program of the Matrix can unjack you by itself?
Like voluntarily release the signal?
Yeah.
That's a huge stretch
and they never hint at it. So
but it makes us
like, we're going to let you out of the Matrix.
It's the difference between shutting your computer off and restart and like safely shutting it down.
Exactly. I wonder if maybe you can go there and say
could
that.
Could be. But then you're also saying that he physically jacked that needle into himself, which seems like it'd be a rough thing to do.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I guess I could see the Matrix.
But this is all headcanon,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Like, none of this is on the screen, so that's a problem.
But I'll also say that it was a hell of a lot of watches before I started thinking about these things. So there again, this is not a one view, like, what the fuck kind of situation.
The other interesting thing about Cypher to me is whether or not he's visited the Oracle. And if
what did she tell him?
What did she tell him? Because she seems to be the orchestrator of all of this.
Yeah, you're right.
I mean, and she is. She proves to be later on, right?
You're right.
Like, she's the program running the whole thing. But
if she told him that you're literally Judas.
Uh-huh. Or told him that Morpheus has found the wrong one. She could set up the situation where he betrays Neo, betrays Morpheus, gets... because.
It's hard to believe giving the access codes to Zion would... like, how she could tell, because I feel like if that was the case, and I actually think you're right. I mean, obviously he did meet the Oracle and she did tell him something. I wonder if whatever she told him had to be something beyond you're going to be evil.
Yeah.
It's got to be something.
She needs to send him down the path. I mean, it's what Morpheus says about it. There's a difference between knowing the path and walking the path, right?
But the way it was very villainous, the way that decided to manifest itself. It wasn't a resigned, I have to do this to save humanity.
If she told him there is no one? I mean, what does that do to his confidence in both Morpheus and this whole idea of the rebellion?
I tell you one question
he might want to go back
that
in.
Keeps me awake at night is why did Cypher think that Agent Smith and the machines would honor their agreement? As soon as he gives Morpheus he just gets flushed down a biological refuse.
And what would he know about it?
Like, yeah, like
he wouldn't even realize it.
Yeah, like why would they plug him back into Matrix? He's already got whatever is the internal tick that makes you want to question it. So why plug him back in? And the Agent Smith portrays that, the way Hugo Weaving portrayed that, is like his bemusement at, oh, yeah, an actor, whatever you want. Just, you know, sure. He's like, whatever, meatbag. Like,
which is a funny line on the face of it. I want to be someone important, like an actor.
Yeah, an actor
saying that's pretty funny.
Joey Pants. Yeah.
Yeah.
But no.
You're right. There's no incentive for them to follow through with that. But in the end, does Cypher care? Does it matter?
Because he just wants out of what he's in.
Yeah. So maybe, like, okay, if they put me back in, great. If they liquefy me and feed me to some other humans,
yeah,
whatever, I'm not going to know.
So that leads me to my next question. Why is the crew of the Nebuchadnezzar such a bunch of fucking stoics? Why are they so damn Spartan? They have... The greatest holodeck of all time at their like I get that you have to eat snot, but instead of eating snot, just to inject like, you know, a feeding tube and go into the Matrix and pretend that you're go into your construct and pretend that you're having a steak dinner, have mouse gin up you. Why is there the stigma about fucking beautiful women in the construct? Like, why don't they live like virtual kings on their off time? Why do they have to sit and go through the discard pile of the Goodwill clothes donation? And like,
I'm with you, man.
Maybe Cypher's not so unhappy if they fucking can cut loose. Like, is there a social stigma about jacking in? If so, what the fuck?
Yeah.
I want to be jacked in.
I feel like there's a little bit of that bleeds over from like Star Trek, you know? Like, you can't without any kind of consequence go into the holodeck and have a crazy sex romp with your crewmates, right? Like, there are scenes that are really fucking weird like that in Star
Trek. Okay, I get it.
And they always have, like, negative consequences.
But Mouse just ginned up this blonde woman from his imagination.
That's what I mean. Like, I wonder if there's some kind of stigma there as regards any fake human being in this scenario. I don't know why there would be. I can't imagine
down on Mouse's sexcapades, and let's boil it down to having a steak meal.
Utilitarian
stuff. That ain't hurting
stuff.
Nobody, and it improves your quality of life drastically.
You're right. You're 100% right. Why eats not?
Yeah. I really don't get it. Like, a little bit of fucking shore leave, Morpheus, and maybe Cypher's not...
Yeah.
Surprise, asshole, at the end.
That's a really good question. Keep your... crew happy.
Speaking of metaphysical and cyberpunk delights and pleasures, what if you got a blowjob in the Matrix while simultaneously getting a blowjob in the desert of the real?
Oh, man.
Would that increase the enjoyment? Like, just from a mental kind of, you know, knowing that your real peen is getting serviced while your e-peen is, would even if you couldn't feel any of the mixed pleasures, like if someone, I'm assuming if someone slaps you in the real world, you don't feel it, but just the kink of it.
Trust me, that's a kink too. Like, all right, I'm going to go in the Matrix and I'm going to have sex with a seven-armed dragon beast, and I want you to be slapping me in the face at my real body the whole time. Guaranteed.
I want to see slap marks.
Yes, I want to get out of here and see physical damage.
I won't be able to get off as hard next time if I don't wake up with with pink slap marks on my face.
Guaranteed.
All right.
Guaranteed people are doing that.
You're right.
So, yeah, I imagine that's probably, like, the double blowjob thing probably is a thing.
What does it mean? When the Oracle tells him that he's not the one, sorry, kiddo.
Here we go. I love this. Okay.
What does that mean?
I think the Oracle has created a fucking pretzel of a plot here that all interleaves in a way that is super satisfying and is not noticeable on first watch. On first watch, you think, okay, so there's some interesting stuff with the vase and that she tells him he's not the one, but it goes so much deeper than that.
Yeah, if you still, really going to bend your noodle is when you ask yourself, would you still have broken if I hadn't said anything?
And that's where the key is, because the things that she tells Morpheus and the things that she tells Trinity all wrap back into his plot, which create the one, right?
We'll be right back with more Bald Move after this brief pause.
Thank you.
Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping. Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info. We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love.
And now, back with more Bald Move.
She effectively creates the one by telling them all these things that come together to show Neo his true potential.
Yeah.
And like that's the thing. Like, she tells Morpheus, you're going to find the one. So Morpheus is so dedicated and he believes it and he tells Neo that.
Yeah.
And then when she tells Neo, you are not the one, and Morpheus is in danger of dying, the only guy who can find the one, he's like, I got to go in there and save him.
Yeah.
It's the only choice I have. And then she has also told Trinity that the one is going to be the one that you love. And that forces her, when Neo sacrifices himself, to bring him back. It's perfect.
Yeah.
I think there's a triangle there.
It plays straight, too.
It does, yeah. I mean, if you buy into the concept that she knows more than the average person in the construct.
Which she would. Like, I feel like that she essentially knows everything that goes on in the Matrix.
I mean,
at least
you get
from
that,
the human standpoint.
You get that from, like, number two and three, right?
Yeah, yeah. Like the architect is the brains behind everything, but she is, like, the one that is responsible for overseeing all the human consciousness and making sure that stuff stays in the air and doesn't seg fault and lose entire crops. Like, that's her job.
Yeah, it's severely disappointing when you find out that she's part of the Matrix and not part of the rebellion.
Well, but I don't know that you can say that.
Okay.
Because she could one argument is that she's working within the system to eventually steer an iteration towards this.
Yeah.
A genuine peace between... Because that's the other trip. Like, I really love a lot of the stuff that was in the Matrix, like anime. What was that called?
The Animatrix. Yep.
The Animatrix. You know, especially the Fall of Humanity. I forget what that... It's a two-part thing. But they actually do a really great job of showing people as the aggressors against the artificial intelligence.
Yeah.
And that, you know, AI, sure, they made it, maybe they've gone too far, they've gone through a overreaction, but we put them through a whole face full of shit.
Uh-huh.
We provoked them.
Yeah, they were our
servants.
We
acted like lunatics.
We treated them like shit.
Yeah.
Because we didn't think that they were sentient.
I mean, there's a lot of things that go with the gun and a lot of social commentary that's not even in the Matrix. This is just something that the Animatrix added to it. But I think it's interesting that you could have a machine construct that is kind of like the Gandhi inside the shell, is that they are trying to work for a genuine peace between equals rather than a one up, one down that's locked us in a cycle of conflict.
Yeah, I mean, that feels like, you know, not quite inevitable equilibrium, but, you know, something that would be tolerable to all involved.
I mean, I think it's super interesting. Like I said, I don't want to talk too much about 2 and 3 just because the podcast will be forever. And also, I selfishly am hoping that people would want to hear us talk about 2 and 3.
All right.
Why commission such a podcast? But I think it's really interesting, the scene in the last one where Smith absorbs the Oracle, the reaction and the chain reaction. I think there's a lot of interesting things that don't ultimately hang together with the Oracle's role, but in the first movie, no complaints in the first movie.
I mean, this movie, I have zero complaints with this movie, honestly. I mean, aside from like a couple of small like questions that maybe aren't even relevant,
but they're fun. They're like, I like a movie that has me talking that way. I ask you this, another one. It seems like you could win any argument in Zion by saying the words, "The Oracle told me this would happen."
All right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The Oracle told me that,
like,
we Trinity's were going to get
tired
down
of your shit. You have you have failed to take out the garbage for a solid month, or you have forgot her birthday, or you just whatever shitbag thing you do. She's walking out the door and you get this stunned look in your face. The Oracle told me this would happen. Like, you know, I need you to give me $200.
You know how fast people would resent that, though? Like, the fourth time somebody pulls that shit, they're like, yeah, well, fuck the Oracle. I'm doing it anyway.
I guess. But like, it seems like there's a lot of currency to be had. And, you know, essentially that, especially since the rules of the Oracle are, don't tell me what the Oracle told you because it's just for you. Except for, I'm going to tell you what the Oracle told me because why not?
Come on, Morpheus. You're breaking the fucking rules.
Jesus, get it together, man.
The guy who's the leader of this rebellion? Come on, man.
The other thing I wanted to talk about is how this movie just doesn't stop.
Yes.
Like,
from the very first scene.
Like, I think even the slow talky parts are extremely interesting, but there's usually a fist fight punctuating it.
Or some really interesting visuals. You know? Like when Morpheus and Neo are sitting on the chairs opposite each other and he's explaining what the Matrix is.
Yeah.
And you're zooming into fucking TVs and hellscapes and it's amazing.
Yeah, like you know, Morpheus is coming out of the walls and fighting Agent Smith. It's like, what is going to be cooler than that? And then the lobby scene, and what is going to be cooler than that? And then
The subway scene. And then the tower scene. And like,
it just never stops to the very end of the fucking movie.
Yeah. And it always seems to be one-upping. I mean, by the end, you've got people literally jumping out of helicopters, explosions behind them.
Like the movie starts off so small and so mundane and then builds to this. Yet it does never for a minute feels ridiculous. It's not to me.
Yeah. Yeah, it's incredible.
I don't know what happened to the Wachowskis, because I've enjoyed some of the stuff they've done since then. Like I've heard Sense8 is really good on Netflix, or
I'm hearing decent things about that. Yeah.
It's uneven, but the concept is good. And I could say the same thing about Cloud Atlas. That was a really high concept, very interesting work that just didn't quite hold together. And then, like, Jupiter Ascending is a miserable mess and cost hundreds of million dollars to make.
Speed Racer was another
Speed
one.
Speed Racer,
did,
which I get, it's a passion project, but
I feel like that was a mistake right after The Matrix.
Well, also, I don't understand why they... Like, if I was going to remake Star Trek The Next Generation, I can't imagine doing the Speed Racer, the movie version of that.
What do you mean?
It's such a slap. It's very slavish in its treatment of the source material and also kind of sloppy and inaccurate.
Huh. Weird.
In the execution,
never saw it, and I don't know the original cartoon.
Like,
so.
I don't know why you just don't make why the fixation of making the live action. Like, make a more gritty adult version of the animated thing. But
yeah,
I don't know. I freaking hated that, and they've had a lot more misses than hits of late. And I wonder, is this a case where they essentially, because even Cloud Atlas is an adapted work, it's not their own original story.
I feel like that's the thing.
But did they just have the one thing in them, and they had like all this fucking Mountain Dew and marijuana and martial arts and anime shit,
yeah,
and cyberpunk shit that they've been grooving on for all their formative years, and they had this one singular work of genius? And then anything else they've had to try to come up on their own just feels very derivative and stale and poorly thought out.
It seems like it to me. I mean, the controversy when The Matrix came out was that it was, you know, heavily inspired. I mean,
but that's
almost
such a bullshit
almost right
argument
out of this book. But then you go to the other two movies and you say, okay, well, these aren't nearly as good. Yes, they're visually just as cool. So from that perspective, it's really good, but the story just kind of, you know, goes on a downhill ramp.
Yeah. When they actually
just kind of falls off a cliff they had to break away from the source material. So I think that might be it. I think they might just be incredible stylists.
Yeah.
With their cinematography and the way they put things on screen. But I don't know that they have those ideas quite under wrap.
I wonder how you fix that. Do you somehow
you put them with fantastic writers, I think.
But surely they've had scripts that they can option and do that stuff, but they choose to either adapt their own material or, you know, go with their own. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not sure either. I mean, they definitely are going for these kind of fantastical stories, right?
Which is fine. I like me some fantastical stories. But like, yeah, I just want to make sure that the Jupiter Ascending was written by them. It is written by Andy and Lana, but it's really bad. Huh. And I
haven't seen it yet.
You know, it feels like they kind of try, maybe they were aiming to do that with like all the stuff that they like, hey, we like this thing out of The Black Hole, and we like this out of Star Wars, and we like this out of Star Trek, and we like this out of Blade Runner. And they try to do that cultural stew with some kind of well-worn, well, I don't want to tell you too much because it's going to be this is going to be the next silent movie. But I kind of feel like that. Yeah, they had a very singular vision about the first one for stuff that they really cared deeply about, and it just happened to be a home run. But certainly haven't been able to recapture that since.
Yeah. Anything else you want to talk about?
I think I'm done.
Okay.
I think I'm done.
I mean, there have been written many, many words about The Matrix, its philosophies, what it means. Okay, one more thing.
I mean, that's the thing. We have not talked about any of the philosophy.
That's what I
feel like.
Go
that's
right now.
Everybody, like, there's fucking hour-long material on the DVDs about the philosophy, and sure, I'm not that smart about it.
The one line that really stuck with me from this movie was when Morpheus says, you know, you cannot be shown what the Matrix is, you have to be told, or you cannot be told what the Matrix is, you have to be shown. I think that is true, 100% completely true. If I were to come up to you, and you know, people talk about this in the real world all the time, like, oh, what if we are just, you know, living in this secondary world that's like a dream or a nightmare, and we can't wake up from it.
My son just out of the blue asked me that last week. How do we know that we're not asleep or dreaming?
Exactly.
And it led to this like really interesting half-hour conversation with an 8-year-old about, all right, let's go down that rabbit hole, son.
But that's the thing. Like, let's suppose for a second that we are.
Okay.
I come to you and I tell you that.
Uh-huh.
You're going to laugh in my face. I mean, you'll consider it. You'll say, oh, that's an interesting idea. I tell you, no, it's true. It's 100% true. I've been outside of it. You go, okay, whatever, dude.
I don't know
whatever.
That I laugh in your face, but my response is, what do I do with this information?
Your response is, A, that's useless to me unless you can prove it. And B, I don't believe it because it's so far-fetched.
Uh-huh.
I really, truly believe that is a universal reaction.
Okay.
That until you are outside of a thing, you cannot get any perspective on it, and therefore you can't even conceive that that's true. So being shown what the Matrix is really is, in my opinion, the only way to convey to someone that this is a reality.
Okay. Where are you going with this?
I mean, that's the thing. That is, I love that statement for how true it is and how you may be able to say, well, is that really true? But I think no. The natural human reaction is my reality and the reality. Until you're proven otherwise.
Well, I think what's really awesome about Matrix as a modern day myth is, like, unlike Leprechauns, where it's like you can't go to the end of the rainbow and find that there is no pot of gold, but you can explain from a meteorological and physics of light situation why there is no such thing as the end of a rainbow, and thus that legend is wrong and leprechauns aren't real, and also we haven't seen the leprechauns.
Sure.
What's brilliant about the Matrix is you can't prove that we are not in the Matrix.
So sure, but that's why I say it's useless to think about until someone can.
But that's the thing, like, it's tantalizing to think that someone could come onto your computer, a stranger, this connection, and convince you with not, like, seeing the Matrix, like, that's the final step, but get you to at least follow by pulling details out of your life that they shouldn't be able to know and predicting the future. And I feel like that's the interesting thing, is, like, this answers the question, is, like, okay, yeah, I'm a brain that's stuck in a jar. Now what? It gives you the now what. Like, it kind of goes back to our debate about Russ Cole's philosophy in True Detective, like, you know, how bleak that is. This is the same philosophy in The Matrix, except for it's not bleak because there's a way out. You can actually fight and resist against it. And I think that's what is kind of interesting. And, you know, it's essentially Plato's cave, only with definitive proof and a way to escape it.
Yeah, I don't know. The thing I don't like about the ideas in True Detective is the resignation to some horrible fate.
But that's what I'm saying. If you, like, let's say someone could convince you, and I don't know what the evidence would look like. Like I'm going to convince you that you are in the Matrix. I'm going to show you videotape of your body in a thing, and that is my body, and I am in that thing. But you're aware of it, but you can do nothing about it now. That is
okay,
I don't
but
know
I'm saying
you
like
would
you
do.
You doubt it until it becomes your reality is what I'm saying. Like,
okay,
you can gin up a tape that shows me in a pod, not hard, right? Yeah. You can come to me and you can tell me I've been outside it. You can say all these things that you shouldn't otherwise be able to know that don't necessarily point to an alternate reality outside of this one. Maybe you've done some research I don't know about. Maybe you've just figured things out. Like, that's what I mean, like, getting to the core of it. Until you're shown that there is, in fact, another reality, I don't think it's something that you can truly believe or understand.
I think the core issue with that statement is that you are not open to the conception of how credulous people are. Like, you yourself are not a credulous person, and you find it hard to put yourself into the mindset of someone who's credulous because there are a lot of people out there that do not require the kind of burdens of proof. And, like, I think the average person, maybe that is a much more compelling or frightening or interesting premise because they could see them being, you know, fuck, people believe, like, there's people listening to this podcast right now, even though we're super skeptics, they believe in ghosts, and there's nothing we can say to talk them out of the fact that they believe in ghosts. Mm-hmm. And I hope it's fun. It's a funny and wry observation to them, but, like, in a world where people believe in ghosts, in a post Scooby-Doo world, I guarantee there's people that would believe in the Matrix without too much in the way of pharmacology or
maybe
convincing.
You're right. Maybe you're right.
And
maybe the
number of people that would be susceptible to that argument is probably higher than you want to believe.
You could be right. In my mind, I'm thinking, you know, extraordinary claim requires extraordinary evidence, and therefore the only evidence that's going to suffice is for me to experience it myself.
The other difference is,
but you're probably right, there are a lot of people out there who would require far less copious amount of data.
I think the other thing is that I'm more willing to entertain, just as a purely intellectual exercise, all realities like that.
Oh man, I entertained, like, the shit out of it after this movie, trust me.
But I'm saying, it's like, but I'm like in almost like, I don't believe in it, but I don't disbelieve in it either. It's like a more agnostic thing.
But that's why I come back to, like, what use is it to me?
Well, that's what I'm saying, like, it doesn't affect how I live my life,
and it shouldn't.
I mean, that's why I'm like, I believe in Russ Cole's philosophy, but I don't like that. To me, it's liberating that like there is no intrinsic value. It's whatever you want to make it.
Yeah, that's where I come from too.
And but I don't begrudge people like Cypher and Russ their delusions about what will happen if they live their life a certain way, because they've gone through a lot of pain and misery that I don't understand.
Sure.
But yeah, I think people are more credulous than you think. And also people are more open to alternative things than dealing with a really unpleasant reality.
Okay. For me anyway, that line struck home because that is basically a truism for myself. I don't think you would ever be able to convince me outside of actually showing me the Matrix.
Sweet shot when he offered a red and blue pill too.
Oh man.
The way that's composited, and like especially the way that it continues to go through, like when Neo, the way it's set, it looks like Neo and in the image that's reflecting the blue pill does not take it.
You got to set this up though, because they have no idea what you're talking about.
Okay, so this is the scene where Morpheus holds out both hands and it's reflected in his glasses.
Yes.
You can see the one hand in one lens holding the red pill and one lens he's holding the other. Mm-hmm. And then Neo reaches out with the hand that's closest to the red pill to take it.
Uh-huh.
But it looks like in the other reflection, since you can't see that hand, it's almost like a Schrodinger's Neo situation where simultaneously he is taking and not taking. And there's so many we're not even scraping the surface about all the philosophical stuff in the movie, because
sure, yeah.
There's that. There's like the Plato's cave thing. There's concept mm-hmm. of deja vu. And I also yep. like how
I love their explanation.
They neatly explain a lot of what we would call like more or less unsolvable, paranormal things.
Anomalous.
Like when someone
events.
Says, I believe in ghosts because I felt a ghost and I heard it speak. Well, what the fuck are you going to say about that, scientist man?
Yeah.
The Matrix neatly explains, and I think that that's really cool about, like, in the second one, they go in to be like, even some of our more interesting monster-type beliefs come from fucking weird shit in the Matrix.
Yeah, and I especially like the deja vu thing, because it's something that everyone, I think, has experienced.
But
right?
It's very hard, like, you can have someone explain why deja vu happens, but when you feel it, it is a very eerie sensation. Like,
oh yeah.
Like, you know, there's, like, I just had a debate with a friend about this, you know, when you turn on the radio and you're thinking about the song that comes on the radio as you turn it on, that is not you tuned into the fucking EM frequency field.
Count the times you do that and it doesn't come on.
You know, No one does.
It's confirmation bias.
That's the whole reason that is a bias. But when you have that sensation, it's such a weird goose pimply sensation that it's hard to say, like, you know, that's just swamp gas reflected off Venus.
Sure, it's
ascending.
dust flying through the air. Exactly.
So I get it.
Yeah, no, I like how it at least touches on that subject too.
I think that then does exhaust my thoughts on the first Matrix.
Yeah, we've talked about it in pretty extensive detail.
Love it. If you haven't seen it, you should see it.
I'm interested in what people think who haven't seen it and now 16 years later are going back and saying, you know, people who are not teenagers, A, and have never thought about this stuff, and B, are not contemporaries with when the film came out.
Yeah.
It's got to be a different experience than me seeing it the day it comes out at 17.
Oh, sure.
And I'm curious what that's like.
Yeah, I agree. Do you think that we should go back and record a spoiler? I feel like we should go back and record a spoiler warning for this. I don't feel that way about a lot of them. But, like, this is, like, you know,
it's just so hard for me to imagine that someone hasn't seen this movie. But you're right. You're right. There are a lot of 17-year-olds
like,
out there right now.
Kind of like The Sixth Sense. Like, I don't know. It's 15 years old. Fuck it.
But, I mean, there were a lot of people born in the year this came out that are now, like, the age I was when I saw it.
I get it, but, like,
and just have never really even heard of it.
I can't, like, there's a certain point where you gotta, if you're listening to a podcast that's recorded on a 15-year-old movie, you gotta assume that it's going to be spoilers.
I would.
And, like,
think
I understand
so,
that the payload of this particular spoiler package is a lot more destructive than any old random movie we've done before, but still, like, yeah. And I also think that not a lot of people are going to sit and watch The Matrix. Like, this might intrigue them enough, if you haven't, to go back and watch it. But, like, if your preconception Matrix is such that, you know, it's like we say, hey, if you ever want to watch this movie and enjoy it, don't fucking listen to this podcast. Go watch it now. Like, I don't think that's going to overcome the 15 years of whatever, you know.
You're probably right. Like, okay, let's say we were covering Citizen Kane. Do you put a spoiler warning because we're going to talk about the ending of that movie? That's
no,
a 50-plus-year-old movie.
No.
So, like, is the difference between 50-plus years and 17-plus years really?
No, I think that, like, I like where we live, where it's, like, the last two seasons and are about that many years of movie watching.
Yeah.
And, like, again, I might be tempted to give some things a little bit more leeway. Like, you know, something along the lines of The Matrix or... you know, I guess The Usual Suspects, something like that. Like if something came out, I'd probably let it go 5 years maybe.
Okay.
Before you start talking about just the end of it. But yeah, I think that our 2 year philosophy is like, you're either going to watch it then, or it's not that important to you. You can't legitimately say, I've been meaning to watch that movie. And you
for
guys
17 years.
Yeah, no, pretty sure you're full of shit. You weren't going to watch the movie. You might watch it now and you're still going to enjoy it as the fantastic movie it is. You just have the twist spoiled for you.
Yeah, I'm with you.
Kind of, sort of. I mean, we haven't spoiled everything.
No, not by a long shot. So once again, I do want to thank Jefferson for commissioning this podcast. You know, it's always easy talking about one of your favorite movies of all time.
Yes.
This is like the second time we've done it. I think, you know, we didn't do commissions on them, but at the Godfather podcast we did, we're both super fun, just purely from an enjoyment of the movie aspect.
Yeah.
This is another one. Matrix, one of my all-time absolute favorite action movies. So, yeah, thank you very much, Jefferson. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, if you'd like to find out how you can commission your own podcast, you can find that information if you go to baldmove.com/shop. That'll take you to our shopping area, our merchandise area, and one of the options, it's the one that looks like the big film reel, is your commission podcast, and find out how you can do that at there. And, yeah, this is like one of the most fun parts of my job. We've got a bunch of stuff. We've got a bunch of stuff coming up. Let me take a peek at the...
And you know what? The heat wouldn't have been bad either.
No.
Gotta say.
No. That's the thing. Like,
I don't think it's as meaty, right?
Well, plus, like, if you're going to give me the choice, I'm going to go with something that I've been primed and ready to talk about for forever, and I'm just kind of waiting for the excuse. Whereas the heat, like, I enjoy the movie, and it's a great movie, and there's a lot to talk about from a De Niro and Pacino standpoint. And
yeah.
But like I would have to do like, you know, go through and read reviews and like look at some critical takes and do all this stuff, where The Matrix, like, shit, man, I'm ready to go.
Yeah. We kind of gave it a courtesy watch on Friday.
Yeah.
Like, you know what? It's been maybe 5 to 7 years since I've seen it.
I had at least 3 new things that I thought about for the first time on that watch.
There you go.
Yeah. I just want to talk about some of the stuff that we got coming up. We've got the next one is the Star Trek The Next Generation series finale, All Good Things.
Oh, yeah.
Another one.
Talk about another all-time favorite.
I've spent a lot of time thinking and talking about.
Yeah.
And I'm really looking forward to doing that.
I think I did a Bald Move TV on this like a year or more ago.
Did you? Like a solo?
Where I had just watched it and I talked about how great it was.
Okay.
It wasn't solo. It was just like, you know, I've been watching.
I know we talked about it in Blue Yonder, too.
Okay. Maybe it was... I'm pretty sure I did a more recent one.
Okay.
So we'll really get into it.
We got V, the miniseries, which was...
I'm kind of excited about that.
I've seen back in the day and when it was a phenomenon. And I remember as a kid talking into House fans to replicate the sound of the alien's voice.
Is that how they did it?
I don't know, but it's what it sounds. It's got that kind of like vibration effect.
Yeah.
So I'm excited to see if that holds up at all. We got a Holy Smoke after that, which I have no idea what that's about. Animal Kingdom, same. Cabin in the Woods as a horror movie.
Yeah, but I've seen that. That's good.
Then Road Warrior. And we just got like 2 more in the last week that I haven't actually added to the board.
Yeah, yeah. Way of the Gun.
Oh,
one of them.
That's a tasty one.
I haven't seen
that. I like
that
one a lot. But yeah, we got a lot more coming out, and feel free to add to our list. We're starting to be able to bang these out on a semi-regular basis, so I'm hoping to get all dug out pretty soon.
Yep. All right. Thanks again to Jefferson, and we'll see you next time.
Bye-bye. Come on!
what you reap is what you sow.